White Aryan Resistance Radio calling. White Aryan Resistance Radio calling. This is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy, right here in the bunker in north central Indiana. And it is, what is it? Oh, it's March the 13th, 2015, and it's Freya's Day, Ladies Day in the bunker. And I played that particular opening there for the webmaster, She-Girl, She-Wolf, and she likes that. So we're going to, maybe we'll use that as our ongoing situation. Okay, let's see. I've got a problem here, I guess, as always. Hold it. I keep forgetting to turn off that Dragon program, which converts speech to print. And if you leave it on and you're trying to record an MP3 file, all kinds of crazy things start happening. So pardon me if I'm sentimental. Well, I see the latest hysteria now is that California's going to run out of water in 1 year, man. You better head for the hills. I learned to dig a well. I'm telling you, it could. I'll tell you what, if they run out of water in California, there's a lot of different things going to happen. And one of the things is there are going to be millions of Mexicans fleeing California if they can't get any water. And a lot of white people, too. You're going to see a lot of mattresses on the top of cars, a reverse Oklahoma situation like in the 20s in the Dust Bowl. But it's not only California, it's all those southwestern states. All of them. Like I say, I wouldn't be surprised if Las Vegas becomes a ghost town one of these days. And all the high rollers make a trek down to Cuba and start all over with the old Cuban thing. Yeah. Because they sure can't depend on Atlantic City. That was a tragic bust, Atlantic City. Of course, you got all these Mongoloid Indian reservation casinos around. They'll keep things going for a while. Here in Indiana, they had a gambling law that the people who had casinos on the rivers or on the lakes, mainly rivers, they couldn't build onto the shore. You know, politicians are so goddamn crazy. So they finally passed a law that now the casinos can get up out of the river and build on the shore. These guys are insane. We're ruled by insane people. Now, on that water in California, there was a fellow, I forgot his name, he was the top dowser called in by the U.S. Army to find water out in the desert for all the military bases in World War II. He lived not too far from me. I never met him. He might have been even dead before I heard of him. I've read a lot of his books on dowsing. Well, I think it was La Mirada there in the L.A. area that they brought him in, and he found a giant source of water, aquifer, under the town. And so they didn't have didn't have to have water pumped in or anything. So maybe everybody in California will head for La Mirada, if that's the town. Well, is Nitwit slipping over there in Israel? Well, final polls show the Likud party trailing behind the Zionist Union 4 days before elections. Most surveys have Netanyahu's party 3 to 4 seats behind Herzog's. This is going to mean very little to you, really, in the long run, because the people running against him are just as radical as he is. It's just that people are getting tired of Nitwit. They're getting tired of Nitwit and his ravings. Well, let's drop in and see what's happening with Nitwit over there in Israel. Seems like he's having a little problem.
One of my researchers out there in Radioland sent me this link. It's from McClatchy Newspapers from today. With less than a week remaining before Israel's elections, the race appears tighter than it has at any time since the start of the campaign, throwing Prime Minister Netanyahu on the defensive. Three public opinion polls published Tuesday and Wednesday show Netanyahu's conservative Likud party lagging by margins of 3 to 4 parliamentary seats behind the center-left Zionist Union Alliance. That gives the Labour Party leader, Isaac Herzog, who formed the Zionist Union Alliance with former Justice Minister Zippy Livni, a fighting chance of unseating Netanyahu, who is seeking an unprecedented fourth term. And the McClatchy article goes on. But in the not to be one to roll over and play dead, Netanyahu has sharpened his rhetoric in an effort to draw conservative voters drifting to other right-wing parties. It's not that Israel wants to get rid of the right-wing attitude. They're just tired of Netanyahu. Keep that in mind. Anyway, in a Likud campaign message, Netanyahu promised, quote, there will be no withdrawals from the occupied West Bank, and, quote, no concessions to the Palestinians. He later lashed out at what he called, quote, a huge effort worldwide to topple the Likud government, end quote, an apparent reference to support by foreign contributors for the campaign to unseat him. Those are contributions made by American Jews, French Jews, British Jews, Russian Jews. It's not a worldwide conspiracy, Netanyahu. It's your own people saying they've had enough of your disgusting rhetoric and your disgusting self. Herzog said on Israel Radio that a rattled Netanyahu, quote, is feeling pressured and shooting in all directions, making false accusations. So there you go. Ask and you shall receive, right? Become a textbook case of journalistic self-delusion by noting, the Post did, that the Russian people have developed an intensely negative view of the United States, but only because the Russian media portrayed the U.S. government in a hostile way. It's the Russians' fault. The Post article by one Michael Birnbaum blamed the collapse of U.S. popularity in Russia on, as Birnbaum put it, quote, furious rhetoric that has been pumped across Russian airwaves, a passionate, conspiracy-laden fascination with the methods that Washington is supposedly using to foment unrest in Ukraine and Russia, end quote. Now, those words are Michael Birnbaum's. The methods that Washington is supposedly using? Jesus! Now, the Post article cited recent polling, noting that more than 80% of the Russian people hold negative views of the United States, but that couldn't possibly be because of America's behavior. Could it? Of course not. It's impossible that anyone looking at the U.S. today could find anything to criticize. Yeah, the sarcasm mode is on. It had to be Putin's fault. It had to be the Russian media spreading all this criticism of God's own country, the United States. Or, as the Washington Post put it, quote, fed by the powerful antagonism on Russian federal television channels, the main source of news for more than 90% of Russians, ordinary people started to feel more and more disillusioned about the U.S. The anger seems different from the fast receding jolts of the past, observers say, having spread faster and wider. I did it again. Back to Perry's article. The only filter that the mainstream media can place on the events like Ukraine is the one that endlessly vilifies Vladimir Putin. And as Perry points out, though this technique of personalizing foreign policy disputes has become standard operating procedure for the U.S. press corps, for example, Daniel Ortega, Manuel Noriega, Saddam Hussein, Bashar al-Assad, Viktor Yanukovych, and on and on and on. The U.S. media's so-called groupthink on Russia may even surpass those earlier examples. Plus, Perry points out that nothing from the Ukraine crisis can ever be blamed on the U.S. government. Oh, no, even though Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland helped orchestrate the violent coup that overthrew Ukraine's elected government in February of last year and threw the nation of 54 million people into a bloody civil war. But no, no, it's never us. Pick a country. We're the rescuers. Vietnam, Guatemala, Nicaragua, the Philippines. Pick a country. Pick one. And 2 days ago, Monday, the Washington Post delivered what Perry calls could become a textbook case of journalistic self-delusion by noting, the Post did, that the Russian people have developed an intensely negative view of the United States, but only because the Russian media portrayed the U.S. government in a hostile way. It's the Russians' fault. The Post article by one Michael Birnbaum blamed the collapse of U.S. popularity in Russia on, as Birnbaum put it, quote, furious rhetoric that has been pumped across Russian airwaves, a passionate, conspiracy-laden fascination with the methods that Washington is supposedly using to foment unrest in Ukraine and Russia, end quote. Now, those words are Michael Birnbaum's. The methods that Washington is supposedly using? Jesus! Now, the Post article cited recent polling, noting that more than 80% of the Russian people hold negative views of the United States, but that couldn't possibly be because of America's behavior. Could it? Of course not. It's impossible that anyone looking at the U.S. today could find anything to criticize. Yeah, the sarcasm mode is on. It had to be Putin's fault. It had to be the Russian media spreading all this criticism of God's own country, the United States. Or, as the Washington Post put it, quote, fed by the powerful antagonism on Russian federal television channels, the main source of news for more than 90% of Russians, ordinary people started to feel more and more disillusioned about the U.S. The anger seems different from the fast receding jolts of the past, observers say, having spread faster and wider, end quote. How can the Washington Post, how can this writer, Michael Birnbaum, write this stuff? How can the Post editors put it out there for whatever public consumption the Post provides, knowing full well that this is American propaganda that's being written here in the Washington Post? Maybe that's why it is being put out there. As if the negative feelings that the Russian people have about the United States is because Russian media is influencing them, making up horrible, nasty stories about the United States. And the Russian media, as everybody will tell you, is utterly and absolutely controlled by the state, and the state is Vladimir Putin. Hence, thus, this is all Putin's dirty work. Nothing that the United States is doing or has done in Ukraine could possibly be at fault. Nothing that the United States has done since the dissolution of the Soviet Union could possibly be at fault. Our surrounding the Russian Federation, what's left of it, with NATO so-called allies now, countries that used to be part of the so-called Warsaw Pact nations, in complete contradiction of what George Herbert Walker Bush promised Mikhail Gorbachev. Nah, it couldn't be any of that. It's got to be that damned Russian media.
Well, that's the latest gathered by rogue progressive Mike Malloy. He gets it from all over the place. Well, this is true. I'm going to tell you straight out, the biggest enemy of the white race in the United States, North America, is the U.S. State Department. Treason is maximized in the State Department of the United States. It starts there. And if you ever want to straighten this country out, some way, somehow, that State Department's either got to be eliminated or totally guillotined. Yeah, because that's where, and it's been going on. I finally figured it out after all these years that the majority of the problems are created in the U.S. State Department that are anti-us. And you can see the way they're firing up the fires of military aggression against Russia. Everything's Putin's a bad guy. They want regime change in Russia. Well, they don't seem to understand that Russians don't think the way we do on many issues. And you can get Putin out, but there'll be another Russian nationalist step right into his shoes. So, anyhow, we have some contacts with friends in Russia. We send this information along because all they get is American crap, corrupt news, totally corrupt. Our news is so manipulated, it's very hard to believe anything anymore. Anyhow, that's it from On the World Scene today, Friday, Freya's Day.
Popular network talk show host after he made derogatory comments about Michelle Obama on air. Rodner Figueroa was on the program El Gordo y la Flaca when he pointed to a photo of the First Lady and said, "Mind you, you know that Michelle Obama looks like she's part of the cast of Planet of the Apes, the film." Figueroa made the controversial statement during a segment on makeup transformations alongside makeup artist Paolo Ballesteros, who was becoming insta-famous for his ability to make himself look like celebrities using different makeup techniques. The show's other host, Raul de Molina, appeared shocked by the racist remark and did his best to smooth things over with several complimentary comments about Obama.
How dare that mestizo talk that late about the First Lady and tell the truth? Like I've said all along, it's not even racist to say that when you see a more black, pure black, with all the Negro look, they look like a primate. I mean, compare it to someone in Iceland or Estonia or someplace like that. I mean, he told the truth, and now he's getting fired. See, you can't tell the truth. She does look apish. That doesn't mean she's a bad person or that she's a bad mother or anything like that. It's just an observation. Well, here's a comment from one of our subscribers, associates, donators. Quote, "I've been sitting and reading the comments by right-wingers about the current Negro riots going on in Missouri. I really am left marveling at the stupidity and the short-sighted reactionary statements coming in. The typical right-winger is advocating for a much more forceful police response. They want looters shot on sight by the police, rioters beaten, gassed, resistors shot down where they stand. They want no arrests, no trials. They want the police to be judge, jury, and executioner right on the scene in the street without any oversight or control. Mind you, these are the very same right-wingers who keep calling for smaller government, less intrusive government, less government control and authority, and more personal freedom and individual liberty, and yet they seem unable to see the hypocritical paradox that they're in. How can you advocate for a smaller, less authoritative government at the same time as you argue for the right of the police, government, to execute people in the streets based solely on police government's version of the necessity to do so. Take the fact that these are Negroes rioting out of the equation for a moment and ask yourself, do we really want this decadent, corrupt, Zionist-dominated, predatory, capitalist, wage slave, enabling, multicultural, endorsing government run by elitist billionaires to endow its enforcers of police with the power and authority to summarily execute people based on their version of events without any oversight or control, without detention, charge, or trial by peers? Because if we support that position, then absolutely nothing prevents those very same government agents, police, from doing exactly the same thing to us at any point in the future. Well, they do gun down white workers occasionally, a lot more than you'd think. The Negroes are rioting because the police executed one of their own who was unarmed in the street. Even though I'm a strict racial separatist, I can still respect that. I wish white people had the balls to do the same when our children are abused and shot down by government as well. In fact, I lament the fact that white people have become so civilized, I call it snivelized, that we don't ever do that. That we routinely let the government intrude into our neighborhoods and into our lives, abuse us and our children with an abuse of force, and that we never do what these Negroes have the balls to do, and that is raise some hell when things happen. I'm a racist race separatist who is cheering right now for the Negro hordes to burn, baby, burn. Yeah, I like that. And it's so very true. This, of course, is what I've been saying all along. This right-wing, conservative, neocon, or whatever you want to call it, patriotic, Republican crap, is nonsense. They are not us. We are not them. They could be us, but we can no longer be them. They either got to come across the line or be classed as the enemy, no matter how white or albino the person may be. This hypocritical stand that most people take on almost everything nowadays is sickening. I mean, look at the gal on the bus from the University of Oklahoma singing nigger, 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 and laughing and smiling and having a ball, but swearing she's not racist. We got a serious problem among whites, especially white right-wing conservatives, who tend to follow that idiot Alex Jones. He's got 33 million listeners. He's got more listeners than any other talk show guy in the country. And he's a bullshit artist. He's a hack. And if you follow most of what he says, you're going to be in deep, deep doo-doo. But that's the state. Now, these people hate us because we have the balls to say what needs to be said. Yeah, they hate us. It just drives them crazy. Part of it's because they feel guilt. A whole lot of that is feeling guilt. And so they say, instead of saying, you know, well, the guy's right, well, they dogpile him. Anybody that says anything, like the one I just said where the guy said Michelle Obama should be in the Planet of the Apes movie. That's his opinion. God damn it, if you can't have an opinion in this country, then let's tear it up. Burn it down. Corruption demands destruction. Hey, what's really going on in Israel with this election? Let's dig into this a little bit. This is from the insiders. What are next week's Israeli elections about? If they were about security and the nation's eternal existential jitters, they would presumably feature candidates with a significant range of proposals and ideas. It's hard to judge a political outfit by the spongy language it puts forward just before an election. But if you want a taste of the essential sameness of Israel's largest parties, here's a pop quiz. Which party vows to keep any future Palestinian state permanently disarmed, safeguard Jerusalem as the eternal capital of the Jewish people, ad nauseum, rejecting the Palestinian right of return, and keeping the blocks of settlements in Judea and Samaria under Israeli sovereignty? That would be the fellows on the left, sounding every bit like the fellows on the right. Is it any wonder that the Israeli voter is bummed out? Hold on a second here. One could, of course, make any number of reasonable arguments about the differences between Netanyahu, nitwit, and the other nitwits, but none are quite as stark as anything the anyone but Bibi crowd would like to believe. Netanyahu, it is true, is an enthusiastic privatizer, and his policies have helped create a class of fantastically wealthy Jews. And the land of Israel, the number five spot in the list of countries with the widest gap between the rich and the poor, right behind the United States. How about that? But rumors of Israeli economy demise have been greatly exaggerated. In the last quarter of 2014, it grew a robust 7.2%. A number that's all the more impressive if you consider the massive blow to Israel's economy caused by last summer's war in Gaza. Don't worry about it. They're replacing all those arms and ammunition free from Washington. The average salary also continues to climb. And if you're not one for economic abstractions, consider this. While the salary of the average American teacher dropped 2% since 2000, that of the Israeli teachers spiked 54% in the same period. These are nice numbers to look at, but Netanyahu detractors can take comfort in knowing that, for the most part, the growth happened regardless of who was occupying the prime minister's office. Well, anyhow, you see there, the same privatizers that are busy in this country making the super rich more super rich, happening the same way in Israel. That's why there's a lot of people living on the streets in Israel, living in tents in the streets. Yeah. So the same old game old, same game here, same game there. Well, Chicago, that wonderful town, the town that Billy Sunday couldn't shut down. I saw a man who danced with his wife. Well, the Tribune newspaper poll shows Emmanuel, the mulatto, with double-digit leads over Garcia, the Spanish boy. He's not Spanish, he's mestizo. Has opened a double-digit lead on challenger Jesus Choi Garcia, gaining support from a majority of voters for the first time in his bid for a second term, a new Chicago Tribune poll has found. Well, that's very interesting. They maneuvered a Mexican into running against him to put on a pretty fair show, but he's going to get his ass beat because Mayor Rahm Emanuel will call in all the markers and all the federal markers and everything else and promise everybody everything to get in. So it looks like the privatization of Chicago continues in a second term of Rahm Emanuel. Whitey, get out of Chicago. Well, let's see what that populist Jim Hightower has been up to lately. He likes to give those Republicrats a lot of hell, those big money people. How about it?
Representative Steve Scalise might not be for sale, but he is available for long-term lease. Assuming, of course, that you're a corporate lobbyist able to put beaucoup bucks into his congressional quid pro quo arrangement. The lease is straightforward. Lobbyists pony up millions of corporate dollars to, as Steve puts it, keep and expand our Republican majority in Congress. Then, that majority delivers billions of dollars worth of legislative favors to the leaseholders. Yes, it's appallingly corrupt, but the transaction is, quote, legal, since lawmakers like Scalise write the rules that give such corruption a pass. The Louisiana Tea Partier is the new number 3 House Republican leader, but he's an old hand at playing Congress's take-and-give game with what he lovingly calls the K Street community. And that community loves him back by stuffing his leadership pack with regular payments. In January, some 300 lobbyists and corporate operatives jammed into a room at the Swank Capitol Hill Club to cheer number 3 as he laid out his corporate legislative agenda, in tandem with laying out his political fundraising program. Lobbyists for American Airlines, Comcast, T-Mobile, and others with big items on Steve's legislative list were winking, nodding, and cheering as their congressman explained that he was, quote, looking forward to a good year for both the lessees and the lessor. One attendee who was beaming with approval was Bill Hughes, who serves as the formal seal on the scandalous money for legislation deal. Until January, Hughes was lobbyist for a slew of big-box retail chains, and he was a major player last year in preventing the House from even considering an increase in America's minimum wage. This year, Bill is Steve's policy director. This is Jim Hightower saying, and they wonder why people think Congress and lobbyists are scum.
Oh, Jimmy boy likes to get right on the back of those bastards in Washington. These crooked politicians that are all over the place. And that's not talking about the lobbyists, those filthy lobbyists.
Shooting of 2 police officers last night.
Response by the police department. By that I mean the St. Louis County Police Department, because the Ferguson Police Department is right now back in control of the city of Ferguson. I actually kind of stayed in touch with this until about 10:30 last night. I went to bed and I was woke up about midnight with the news. At about 8:15 last night, protesters started blocking South Florissant Road in front of the PD. Ferguson called a code 1000, which means the closest 25 cars that could be available to assist them at 8:27. Approximately 150 protesters were located in the roadway, 15 police officers on the scene. At 9 o'clock, Ferguson makes one arrest of a protester in the roadway on the charges of failure to comply being in the roadway, endangering the welfare of a child and resisting or interfering with arrest. Protesters leave the roadway. At 10 o'clock, due to the amount of people that are in the roadway, another code 1000, additional 25 officers come in. Eventually, we end up with 69 police officers that respond. At 10:30, Ferguson makes an additional arrest of a protester in the roadway, and at 11:15, they make a final arrest. Now, at this point, we are beginning to see the crowd begin to diminish. And in fact, by about a quarter till midnight, we're beginning to see not only the crowd beginning to leave, but we're also seeing the police officers that are going to be leaving, at least some of them. I would imagine we had 75 protesters, probably 40 police officers left at this time. So we're thinking that it's thinning out. At 12 a.m., we hear three or four shots ring out. Some of you have seen that on the media. These are shots that aren't in the air. They're not in the ground. One way you can tell is when you listen to the audio, you can actually hear those shots singing. Those shots immediately strike 2 officers that are standing next to each other. But I'd like to underscore that these officers are also standing in a line of about at least 20 to 25 officers. So we have a group of officers standing there. It's very evident that we have a group of officers standing there. And the Webster Groves officer is shot right here at the high point of your cheek, right under the right eye, and the bullet lodges right behind his ear. And that bullet is still with him. He's going to have further evaluation to figure out what they're going to do with that round. The St. Louis County officer was struck right here on the shoulder, and the bullet came out the middle of his right back, between the scapula and his spine. Now, fortunately, with both officers, we don't have any remarkable long-term injuries. In other words, it wasn't in somebody's brain or heart or anything like this. But you need to know, these two officers took a very hard hit. I mean, any time that you're shot in the face and have a bullet lodged in your head, any time that you have a through-and-through wound where the bullet enters your shoulder and comes out the middle of your right back, those are hard hits. So we're lucky, by God's grace, we didn't lose two officers last night. So one of the things that I've talked about is that we do need to understand as a community, and we certainly understand it as a police department and as law enforcement, that we have an obligation to make sure that folks that want to express their First Amendment rights have the ability to do that. But when you look at the tenor of at least some of the people that are involved in the protest or civil unrest, it at times can be very troubling. And it's difficult for the officers to discern within a crowd of folks that are perhaps there for the right reason exactly who's doing what. And one of the problems we have is, similar to the last night, I would have to imagine that these protesters were among the shooters that shot at the police officers. And for the police officers that are standing there and really don't have the ability at nighttime to understand what they're looking at, it's dark, there's a whole lot of people out there, there's a lot of noise, it's very difficult for the officers to really understand what they're looking at the time and really to be able to evaluate any type of threats. So, you know, I would just tell you that you need to understand that. I think it's a miracle that we haven't had any instances similar to this over the summer and fall. With the amount of gunfire that we would hear, that I personally heard last summer and fall, I think it's a miracle we haven't had something like this happen. And I think we're very fortunate that has happened. I'd also like to point out that my officers tell me that when this happened, when they heard the shots and when they heard the bullets singing past, that they saw muzzle flashes. But these muzzle flashes were probably about 125 yards away. Many officers drew their weapons, but no officers fired. But what if we're in a situation to where it's 25 or 50 yards away, and it's a threat right there in front of you that can be engaged, except we're around a situation to where perhaps 40, 50, 60, 70 people are around? I mean, we really need to understand the dangers of this. And I'm not blaming anybody other than the individuals that took a shot at my officers and hit them, but I am telling you that these are situations that it's very difficult for us to navigate through if you're a police officer on the street and you're doing everything you can to protect people's First Amendment rights, everything you can to protect other people's rights, maybe traveling through the area, anything that you can be doing to protect life and property. This is another layer that makes it very difficult for our police officers out there to deal with. And I hope people understand that, because it's a very tricky line for us to be able to walk. Ladies and gentlemen, we were very close to having happen what happened in NYPD with Officer Ramos and Officer Liu. We could have buried two police officers next week over this. And I didn't really expect the amount of agitation at times that we saw last night out of the crowd based on the news that happened yesterday. And not everybody there expressed agitation, but we certainly are always cautious. But I didn't expect, obviously, either that we would have two police officers shot last night. One of the officers from St. Louis County is a 41-year-old. He's a 14-year veteran of law enforcement. The Webster Groves officer is 32 years old, and he's a 5-year veteran of law enforcement.
Well, that's the chief, the great high sheriff out down there in Ferguson. Well, here's an interesting little bit of news. It's a lone wolf, a really lone wolf. A wild wolf was caught on film in the northern Netherlands for the first time in over 100 years. An expert from the group Wolves of the Netherlands said that the wolf may have wandered over from Germany, where one could presume there are many wolves. The spotting comes about a year and a half after a dead wolf was discovered on the side of the road in the Netherlands. The incident sparked controversy over whether the wolf had been living there or was deposited by the road post-mortem as a joke. Well, that's interesting. That is very interesting that the wolves are making a comeback in Europe. And another from Europe, the Norwegian Arctic island of Svalbard is turning tourists away for an upcoming solar eclipse, citing a lack of hotel rooms and an overabundance of polar bears. Polar bears must be moving south. Well, I guess Obama's afraid to do almost anything with the program to send things. President Barack Obama doesn't send text messages, rarely composes his own tweets, and isn't allowed to have a smartphone that contains a recording device, he said on Thursday. And don't ask him for Hillary Clinton's email address. He won't give it to you. I do not physically tweet in general, the president said in an interview with ABC program Jimmy Kimmel. I don't text. I email. I still have a BlackBerry, he said. If I was him, I wouldn't use those things either, because none of that stuff is safe. Well, finally, some movement on Julian Assange, who should be a national hero here in this country and even Europe. But there's some things coming up. Let's see what it is.
Swedish prosecutors have decided to question Julian Assange in London, ending perhaps 3 years of a diplomatic impasse. This is Alistair Scruton for Reuters in Stockholm. For 3 years, prosecutors in Sweden have refused to go to London to question Assange over sexual allegations. Assange and his supporters say it's very likely that he would eventually be extradited to the United States to face a secret grand jury investigation into the release of thousands of diplomatic files through his organization WikiLeaks. The other thing that actually may complicate things is having been holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy to escape the British attempts to extradite him, he actually may face charges in the British justice system for escaping bail.
Well, let's check in with Max Kaiser, that old money man over there, see what he's got to say this week.
As a report, I'm Max Kaiser. You know, President John Adams said, facts are stubborn things, and whatever may be our wishes, our inclinations, or the dictates of our passion, they cannot alter the state of facts and evidence. John Adams, what's he up to, Stacy?
Well, he was talking about facts and evidence often get in the way of ideology and like claims and hopes and wishes. And wishes were conditions, we would all be fat, of course. But the facts are getting in the way of many of our so-called beliefs about the way we live and are and our economies are doing in these headlines today. How 30 years of a polarized economy have squeezed out the middle class. The number of middle-income households in England is falling as the extremes of rich and poor rise, with London highlighting the divide. So they looked at the data across the UK from 1980 to 2010. What they found is England is increasingly divided between the rich and poor, with a 60% increase in poor households and a 33% increase in wealthy households. This has come at a time from 1980 to 2010 when the number of middle-income households went down by 27%.
Well, David Cameron talks about his long-term economic plan, that they want to stick to it. And I don't know why he would, because it's generating poverty. So if the plan is to create poverty, then he's succeeding. If the plan is to create some kind of growth, then he is failing.
Well, it also created wealth, because as they point out, there was a 33% increase in the wealthy, a 60% increase in the poor. So they're destroying the middle class. And the middle class has, of course, always been a big problem for all political, you know, they cause political revolutions, or the voters that go out and everything, all policy has been geared towards the middle class. But London has been the worst. for the situation, even more extreme than the rest of the country. And what we've seen is the trend is most marked in London. According to an analysis of census data by Benjamin Henning and Danny Dorling of the School of Geography and the Environment at the University of Oxford, over the 3 decades, the capital has seen an 80% increase in poor households, an 80% increase in wealthy households, and a 43% decrease in middle households. So around 36% of London households are now classified as poor, up from 20% in 1980, while 37% are middle income, down from 65%.
Well, do you include rapacious landlords in the category of those benefiting from long-term economic plans? Or do you look at the big picture and say that the number of poor people increasing defines the failure of that program? That, albeit, does generate more rentier, profit-seeking parasites, that's true. And more in this country, the parasite is the hero. They should replace the flag with a parasite.
Well, if you look at the data, and I'm sure it's similar in the United States as well, government policy has helped the poor. They get the wealth transfer of food stamps and free housing, Medicaid in America. The huge cost in America, for example, is healthcare costs. Those fall largely on the middle class who can't afford it. In education costs, huge cost falls on the middle class who can't afford it, but the poor get subsidized on that. And the rich, of course, get subsidized with monetary policy. The monetary policy is wealth transfer. It's not a fiscal transfer like from the food stamp policies, for example. But so you're seeing the top and the bottom. The government has selected the winners in this situation, and it's not the middle class. And also in this data in London, for example, I thought it was quite remarkable that they said that back in 1980, 75% of the population of Westminster Council was middle class. Now less than a third are. So if your government is sitting in Westminster where there are no middle class, you know, that impacts the way they look at the economy. They look at all around them in Westminster are very wealthy people.
Yeah, I've used the metaphor of the caldera, of the volcano. So this quantitative easing eruption of free cash is resulting in a caldera, which is the rim around the volcano with very high peaks surrounding an abyss. So the poor people are in the abyss, and those rent-seeking Westminster types are sitting on the edge of the caldera. And this is the result of quantitative easing, volcanic eruption of magma, free magma money.
Why are you shaking your head like...
It's magma money. It's money from the magma. And the only way to stop it, really, is to think in more cosmic terms.
Well, they do look at the data, and they suggest that the housing is a large part of the reason why there's such a big gap growing between, well, basically that they're only rich and poor. And they said the economic divide between the beneficiaries of the property bubble and non-homeowners also continues to widen in the country as a whole, with upward pressure on land values. And in terms of London, they also say that in 12 of the 33 boroughs in London, 12 of the 33, the poverty rate has doubled between 1980 and 2010. So what I'm saying is that at the top of the show, you were saying that the facts, if they contradict your claims. So we've claimed over the past 20, 30 years that this whole Thatcher revolution has created a huge amount of wealth, and it has, but it has also created a huge, even larger pile of poverty.
That's right. The facts are that these policies of long-term economic growth are creating poverty, unbalanced poverty. That's what they're creating. Those are the facts, as John Adams would eloquently say. The propaganda is that there's a trickle-down effect where the rentier class is somehow going to trickle down and enhance the middle class, but the middle class is being eviscerated. It's evaporating. It's being destroyed by these policies that are nonsensical from the current leadership in the United Kingdom.
Of course, that gap is part of the ladder of the American dream. When you climb up out of poverty up to the upper classes, if you remove a whole spoke, it becomes harder and harder to catapult yourself up to the next level. And I want to look at another set of data, of facts, which are very...
It reminds me of a Miro. the famous artist, if you look at his paintings, there's always a little ladder somewhere in the tableau. It's usually on the periphery. And I think what the artist is suggesting is that within the vortex of this calderic explosion of the middle class, the ladder, whether it's the property ladder or the American dream ladder, is being obliterated and sidelined. This is the mind of the artist has clearly captured this obliteration.
So I want to look at another set of data that, and facts that contradict the myth. And the myth is that we have this American dream. And certainly since World War II, we had an emerging middle class, more and more wealth going down to the middle from the top, as we had prior to World War II. We've had a growing life expectancy, especially for white women. This has been, they're now living much, much longer. But that trend has turned around, and a remarkable story here. What's killing white women? The mortality rate for white women in the United States has surged. So you can see this chart here from the death rates for white women from 15 to 54 years old from 1999, and you see it's climbing, climbing, climbing. Well, that's up 12% since 1999. Part of the jump in the death rate for whites is explained by the epidemic of prescription painkiller abuse and overdoses that disproportionately affected whites. But that accounts for only half the total increase, according to the report. Other causes of death on the rise include suicide and respiratory disease. And they say especially these chronic diseases like respiratory disease and diabetes. So chronic diseases, as are the health insurance system in the United States, covered less and less and less. So if you had a chronic disease, you were unable to afford to all your insulin, for example, because you were having to make more and more co-pays since 1999 as your cost of insurance, cost of caring for yourself, but also as inequality rose, and this caused more and more stress for the middle class. Yeah,
that's right. White women are being bumped off. By who? White men. The people who run these big pharmaceuticals, who sell these opiates, oxycodone, over the counter, bumping off white women. Who's responsible? Whitey. Whitey. That's who's responsible.
And then they look at the authors of this report look at this is a remarkable event. This sort of huge jump in mortality rates happens very rarely in history that this sort of thing happens. It's usually with epidemics. They compare it to Dickensian London during the Industrial Revolution. You also had a sudden spike in high death rates, mortality declining. So you were having more and more people die unexpectedly earlier than would normally be expected. And they say we don't have enough evidence to tell whether the increase is a temporary one linked to painkiller abuse or if it's a long-term shift. The authors cite examples of other short-term spikes in mortality. Death rates increased for black women in the U.S. during the crack epidemic. For Russian men, death rates linked to alcoholism are still high but appear to be declining. So after the collapse of the Soviet Union, for example, there was a huge spike in alcohol-related deaths in the post-Soviet Union as, well, chaos ensued and the Yeltsin free-for-all Washington consensus poured upon the nation and destroyed it. So, you know, you're seeing a similar thing. The Western press is very interested in that story in particular, but you don't see this particular story covered more often, that this massive historical spike in deaths in white women. It's still not as high as the death rate for black women, but it's a huge and sudden, unexpected jump.
Well, yeah, I mean, those are the facts. Those are the facts, and there should be a very obvious conclusion drawn from these facts, that the policies that are putting these opiates into the hands of these women is a busted policy that should not be supported, and yet nobody's acting on those facts. They're acting on the profits of the pharmaceutical companies that are booking huge gains and the executives booking huge bonus payments, selling these white women these opiates and killing them. That's what they look at as economic growth. The detritus of their failed policies is never considered.
Yeah, but also, like the financial media, basically we just don't talk about this. The fact that something as seismic as the collapse of the Soviet Union has happened in America since 1999. Of course, we did have two mega financial collapses. We had the NASDAQ bubble collapse, and then we had the 2007-08 financial crisis collapse that also caused a lot of depletion of wealth in the average population, and the rich got richer every time in that, and the growth of the poor happened. Now, Mother Jones, about this report, said, quote, such a wholesale and systematic reversal in life expectancy trends is extremely extremely troubling. The researchers say an extreme indicator that suggests large health declines in a broader population and an indication that income inequality may be taking its toll on women's health. So we still have a myth, a very strong and powerful myth, that we're all created equal, everybody has a chance in America, it's all equal chance, there's a middle class, you can rise up to the middle class and become wealthy, but the numbers, the data, the facts is suggesting that something is going horribly wrong, and it, in normal circumstances, this would be a historical event and people would want to know what's happening.
Well, stay tuned for the second half, a whole lot more.
The racist struggle is going on hot and heavy in France. An ex-candidate of France's National Front will spend 9 months behind bars after she posted a photo on Facebook comparing the country's justice minister, who is a Negroid woman, to a monkey. The sentence exceeded the prosecutor's request for a 4-month jail term. There you go, war on whites. You can't say anything about Negroes. The court in the French overseas city of Cayenne, capital of French Guiana, gave the author of the post, Anne-Sophie Leclerc, a 9-month prison sentence and a €5,000 fine. The former candidate didn't appear in the court, and later she said she would appeal the verdict. I'll tell you, man, whitey, you better start fighting back. The right-wing National Front was also fined €30,000 as Leclerc was the party candidate in this year's local elections in the region of Ardennes, northern France. However, she was excluded by the organization in December 2013 after the incident. The photo montage with a picture of a baby monkey with a caption underneath reading, at 18 months, and the photo of France's Justice Minister Christine Tabari with words "now" appearing on the Facebook page of Leclerc on August 31st. She later deleted the controversial photo. However, the photo montage was revealed by France TV channel, TV channel 2, in October. This gal had some guts during a France 2 documentary. Quote, the new faces of the National Front, Leclerc was confronted with the image. She defended her post, saying that Tabari was a wild animal. Quote, honestly, she's a wild animal, coming on TV with that devil's smile, she said. I'd prefer to see her swinging from a tree than in the government, she said. Now that's who they should run for president of France. She also denied that the photo montage was racist. Well, she shouldn't do that. Quote, I have friends who are black. Oh, Christ, get out of here. I take all that good stuff back. I did not make racist remarks, even though my comments on television were clumsy. According to the ex-National Front activist, the photo was merely a joke. The photo was posted on my Facebook page, and I took it off a few days later. I was not the creator of this photograph. The case was brought by French Guiana's Walwari political party, founded by Christine Tabari in August 2013. It wasn't even in France, this thing. So a French woman's going to have to suffer for that, 9 months in jail. According to the ex-National Front activist, the photo was merely a joke. You can't joke. You can't joke. You're living under a police state. The photo was posted on my Facebook. In the meantime, the country's National Front slammed the court sentence as revolting and excessive. Well, they should have tore down that, Party officials said they would make an appeal. Until you get rough and tough, nothing's going to change, Mr. Froggy. This must be the one of the harshest sentences handed in a long time for freedom of speech. There's no freedom of speech. If they don't want you to have freedom of speech, they'll give you a privilege of speech. Anytime they want to drag you away, they'll do it, you know? Until whites get off this kick of saying, well, I put a picture of her, she's a monkey and an animal, but I'm not a racist, you know? Just until whites come out and say, I am a racist, I am for the white race, I am a white separatist, Until they get the balls to do that, forget it. Nothing's going to change. Nobody respects cowards.